The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good morning and thank you very much for having me again at the City Bible Forum legal chapter. It's great to be here with you. I'd like to begin today by giving a bit of an introduction to the series of talks that I'm going to be giving over the next 3 weeks. It falls into three parts, and each part is, I've got a building as a symbol. So buildings are remarkable expressions of cultural aspirations. And we think of cities and civilizations, we think of their buildings. We think of Big Ben, we think of what happened with the Twin Towers in New York, and what that symbolised, and what breaking, you know, cracking those open, what destroying those symbolised. We think of our own city, and we think, of course, of the Opera House and the Harbour Bridge, and what that means for us, what that symbolises for us in Australia. I think it's our attempt to be cultural, isn't it, to have an Opera House in city as our symbol. And so the three buildings we're looking at over the next 3 weeks, we're starting with the building today is the Tower of Babel. Next week we're looking at the Temple. And then finally, the symbol is the arena. And the other symbol, the other image that I'm using is the idea of dreams, the idea of dreams. And so this week, the dark dreaming, next week, a new dream. And then lastly, dreaming with God, dreaming today, what we need to dream about in the present. I'd be talking about culture over the next three weeks, and culture is one of those words which, if you ask someone what culture means, if you ask a cultural studies expert what culture is, each expert will have at least two opinions. It's very, very one of those words that, in fact, you can have a massive discussion just defining what it is. I've got a very simple definition of culture. Culture is what we do around here. Culture is what we do around here, or you might say culture is the software on which we run on the hardware of place and time. So culture is what we do, what we people do here in this place at this time, the software on the hardware of place and time. So what about today, the dark dreaming? Well, I'd like to explain today something, again, quite straightforward, and that is that humankind is tragically flawed, and culture expresses and intensifies our tragic condition. The culture is both a bellwether, a symptom, a description of our tragic condition, but also intensifies our tragic condition. I don't know if you're a fan of Shakespeare. Even if you aren't, I think you probably have to admit that you have to pretend that you are just to get on in life. But of course, his greatest plays are tragedies, Othello, Hamlet, King Lear, Julius Caesar, Macbeth, and so on. And of course, what is tragedy? Tragedy never ends well for the tragic figure, the tragic hero. That's the point. That's why it's called a tragedy, because the tragic hero always has, you might remember this from high school, he always has a flaw. There's always a flaw. There's something that brings him down in his character. He's admirable and noble. In fact, it's not a tragedy if he's just kind of evil. He's got to be good, or she's got to be good in some way, noble and talented in some way, but the crack distorts his personality and brings him down in the end. In fact, tragedy is itself a statement about the whole of humankind. It's an anthropological statement, the form of tragedy. As a race, we are made for extraordinary things, but also tragically flawed, capable of extraordinary achievements, but unable ever to live up to our promise. We always fall short of the promise that is there within us of our talents and who we are. You can see this from Pascal's quote here. I've got it on the sheet. And this is a very famous thing that Pascal said. What a chimera then is man, what a novelty. I think he was echoing Shakespeare in saying this. What a monster, what a chaos, what a subject of contradiction, what a prodigy, judge of all things, feeble earthworm, depository of truth, a sink of uncertainty and error, the glory and the shame of the universe. That's our paradoxical condition. And of course, Shakespeare has his hero, Hamlet, say, what a piece of work is man. Because we use the word piece of work to mean, oh, well, he's a piece of work. It's a kind of ambiguous thing to say, isn't it? What a piece of work, whereas he's saying here, what an extraordinary piece of artistry is man. How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form and moving, how express and admirable in action, how like an angel in apprehension, like how like a god. The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals, and yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust? Man delights not me. Humankind is glorious, yet tragically broken. We say, to err is human. We are a byword for mistake making. That's, you know, if we want to talk about someone who makes mistakes, we talk about them being human. Or we say of ourselves, I'm only human. We name that, when we say that, we name our own imperfection and limitation. At the center of the human tragic condition is our pride. That's partly our paradox, isn't it? We can see how good we are, how much potential we have, and yet that, in a sense, is what brings us down. We are blind to our limitations. A man's got to know his limitations, after all, said that great philosopher of the 20th century, Clint Eastwood. But we don't know ours, and we don't like to accept them. We imagine we are gods. And human culture, when human beings get together, is an amplifier of this tragedy. This is, of course, what the Bible has to say about us as individuals and about us when we get together, when we share things in common and when we have culture and civilization. So we can see, when we look with biblical eyes, this tragic story expressed through human culture. So I'm up to point two here, the Tower of Dreams. Genesis 11 is the text I'm bouncing off today, but I want to start back, of course, in Genesis 1 and 2. Because human culture itself is not created to be negative, just as it's created to be bad or doomed to be as it is. In Genesis chapter 1, when God creates man and woman in his image, he invites them to fill the earth. And so already he says to human beings, you are destined to be a plurality. There's going to be more than just the two of you. There's going to be a plurality of humanity, and you have a task, you have a mission. And culture and civilization is there as a mission, as you go out to cultivate the earth, to live in the earth and bring order to it. I don't think the vision of Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2 is of a kind of island paradise with people walking around just without civilization, without kind of organizing themselves together. They're meant to order the earth and to have dominion, rule over it. So that's the vision for the good vision for human culture that we get in Genesis 1 and 2. And of course, in Genesis chapter 3, we get the unwinding, the breaking down, the tragic story of the first human couple, and civilization becomes then a complex and paradoxical beast, just as human beings themselves are. It lives under the mark of the fall. Just as the first human beings are fall, and as they are cursed, of course, they give birth to the first twins, the first set of brothers. And as the Australian poet A.D. Hope, in this extraordinary poem about Adam and Eve, he talks about the birth of the first baby, who is Cain. And the last line of his poem is, "And so the first murderer was born." Of course, if you know Cain and Abel, of course, that pair of brothers, that ends very badly with Cain murdering Abel. Now, that story is useful for us in our study of culture because it's Cain who goes out into the world and who fears for his life and so founds the first city. He and his descendants found the first cities. They become the sort of the founders of human collective civilization. And so instead of human civilization, human culture being an expression of our goodness, our service of God, human cities are built to protect us from the wild animals, to protect us from nature which should have been our natural home, our playground, and instead to shut it out and to protect us from other human beings and to protect us from wild nature. And so cities are founded for protection. Now, cities are founded for our protection, but soon they become symbols of our pretension. And if we know about the ancient Near East, cities themselves were sort of not simply, they were not simply walled cities, which they were not simply functional. They, of course, expressed aspirations and dreams, and in fact, they had a highly religious significance. And so each city had its own god, its own holy name, its own spiritual significance. And so cities soon enough become ways of not just shutting out the world, but shutting out the true God, and of expressing their own sort of spirit, their own pretension. Gods become attached to different cities around the ancient Near East. And that's true too in the first chapters of Genesis. We see that as human civilization grows, we see the human rejection of God continuing. Until we get, to cut a very long story short, to chapter 11, where we get this extraordinary story, almost cartoonish story, of the Tower of Babel. If you want to meditate on this story, you can do nothing better than look at Bruegel's paintings. He's done a couple of paintings of the Tower of Babel, and the most extraordinary things. They're beautiful. I'd really like to get a massive print on the wall. Busy paintings, you know. They're almost like the precursor to Where's Wally, would you say? That busy. So Bruegel on the Tower of Babel. But this story, one of my favourite stories in the whole scriptures, it's kind of it's cartoonish. It's meant as a satire of human pretension in civilization. It's meant to be slightly funny. I think not in a kind of ha-ha, belly laugh way. It's meant to be a piece of poking fun at those who would set themselves aside from the true God. So we see from the beginning of this story the intention in verse 3 of the human beings who gather together to build this tower. Let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we'll be scattered over the face of the whole earth. So this is a dream. This is a dream, an aspiration. This city won't just be any city. It will have a tower that reaches to the heavens. And if we aren't kind of clear about what this tower will mean, they also say, we will make a name for ourselves here. This is a moment for independence, a moment where these human beings will step out, aside from the worship of God, aside from their Creator, and make a name for themselves. And they will be able to ascend to heaven in order to sit side by side with God, to be heavenly themselves. They're to straddle the earth and to take God's place through the building of this tower. And this is a story about what human culture can turn into, an attempt to do what only God can do without God, an attempt to shut him out, to build ourselves a world in which he is not necessary, a kind of complete all-in-one world in which worship of the true God is not necessary. A bit like a shopping centre. A shopping centre encloses you. You walk into the shopping centre, everything is there. You feel like you may never escape, of course, but that everything is there for you, and there's no shop that isn't there. There's no world necessary outside the shopping centre. It's a kind of dangerous illusion that shopping centres want us to have, I think. Likewise here, they want to have the city, to build the city, the civilization, that means you don't have to go outside. You don't actually have to go anywhere outside it. This is what culture does for us under this sign of the dark dreaming. It cons us into thinking that it's ultimate, that we will, for instance, be satisfied with our consumption as a substitute for worship of the true God, or that life here in this place will deliver everything that we long for, or that our career will be something that expresses our true inner authentic selves, that we will be massively fulfilled in our work, in our participation in the city through our work, or that if only I am thin enough or fit enough, or that I work hard enough, that I will have what I want. These are the great myths of modern culture, as they were in the ancient world too. Now, God has, of course, a different dream, and you see how in this story, the dream of God comes up right against the dream of these human beings who built this tower. He's got a different dream. He's invited human beings to share it with him. The creation was his vision, and he'd invited human beings extraordinarily to join with him in doing it, to have dreams and to have their own dreams and to express them under his authority. He'd invited them to till and to fill and to name and to claim the earth. That's as close as I get to being a rap star. To bring the earth to its potential. I think this is a marvellous thing about creation, that God gives human beings creation but doesn't give them a kind of blueprint for what they're to do with it. He says, go and do what needs to be done. Go and see the potential in it and bring it out. So he gives them enormous freedom. You can see this in the story of Adam naming the animals. He doesn't play 20 questions with Adam when Adam comes up. I think I talked about giraffes when I was last here. talking about the beauty of the world. I'd imagine when the giraffe comes past and Adam's supposed to name the giraffe in that story in Genesis chapter 2, it's not like God saying, okay, this tall creature, guess its name, begins with a G, ends with an E. And Adam goes, don't know, two F's in the middle. I know, giraffe. Yes, says God, that's the name. It's not like that. He actually brings the animals to Adam to see what Adam would name them. It's Adam is able to express himself. He's given the freedom, the invitation to share in God's world by looking into the essence of things and using his language to describe what he sees around him. An extraordinary moment to share this glory, with the glory of this life together with God, and the joy of it, to enter into God's rest. This was, we'd have to say, the dream life. But as the story unfolds, we see the human beings are determined to pursue their dreams without God. Now, it's God's mercy, and this is important for us to realize, I think, that everything good is not destroyed in the earth. In the pattern of Genesis 1 to 11, we see God restricting human beings, punishing human beings. But in his mercy, he doesn't destroy everything. He always allows a remainder to continue. He doesn't let the goodness of the world just slide into sludge. The world has not become a kind of hell. The world is still holds together. We can still catch glimpses of his glory. We can still see good in the world. We still know what should be, even just from our experience of the world, in his mercy. But the ongoing tragedy of humankind is that we keep self-vandalizing. We destroy the things that are given to us for our benefit. And of course, this comes out in the tower here. There's nothing wrong with building a tower per se. I don't think tower building is somehow offensive to God or a bad thing to do. But it becomes an attempt to challenge God, this building of a tower. And it becomes futile in the end. In fact, one of the great jokes here is that they're making it of bricks. And we're supposed to, if we're ancient Near Eastern listeners, if we're Jewish listeners listening to this text, when we hear, come let us make a tower and we'll build it of bricks, we're supposed to laugh. Because that's ridiculous, the idea in the ancient world that you'd use bricks to make anything significant. You make something significant out of big stones. That's what you do. You don't kind of make these. Brick building is ridiculous for them. It's silly. And so there's a sort of hubris here in the tale, which is that they're going to use a kind of primitive technology that just can't work to build this tower. It's destined to fall down. And in fact, at the end, Peter pronounced it correctly, the word Babel, or we've always pronounced it Babel, is in fact the word Babel, and it means in Hebrew exactly that. It means nonsense. This is the tower of nonsense, because God confused the languages there. This is the tower that is silly. And of course, it also reminded the Jews of their neighbours down the road, the people of Babylon. So it's a kind of pun on their name, saying, you know those that apparently impressive civilization down the road that looks like it's going to invade you and destroy you? That's really the nation of silly people, right? That's the nation of babblers. That's who they are. So this tower falls under the judgment of God. I meant to say, too, one of the things that's, again, supposed to be funny here is that the Lord God has to come down out of heaven to even see the tower. So they've tried to make this tower to reach up to the heavens, but God can't, you know, it's meant to be funny, that got cartoonish, that God can't even see it from heaven. He has to come down out to have a look at it, because it's just such a pimple on the face of the earth. It's not really that significant after all, despite our human pretensions. So it falls under the judgment of God, which you can see is also a mercy, because it prevents human beings collaborating together and imagining that they can do what they've attempted to do here. God protects us from ourselves through his judgment. So what we see here in this story is that without God, human culture is hubristic, it's harmful to us, and not least because it always puts in place a God substitute, which is what makes our dreaming dark. So the Bible tells us that where we now live is in the midst of a culture in which the human tragedy is played out and even intensified as our deepest longings are reflected and misdirected. Our cultures become expressions of something, not just something good about us, but something dark about us too. I think this is true of Australia, unfortunately. There are some great things about Australia. I'm proud to be Australian. But when Australians, when you hear people saying, using Australia as a sort of almost like a faith that you would have. Australianness is a myth to which we should subscribe. You know that violence isn't far away, strangely enough. You know that something ugly is possibly there. We know what nationalism can do, for example. We know what parochialism can do. It's very hard to be excessively proud of our own culture without also denigrating another culture. We human beings find it very, very difficult. As a result of God's mercy, human culture, including our own, produces much that's good. And, well, that's the nature of tragedy, isn't it? But that good is often directed towards doom projects we could see again and again in human history. We can still see the created magnificence of humankind in culture, and with biblical eyes, we can see also in human culture the desire to be independent of the loving and governing God. We want to be self-governing. I think of the mobile phone, which is perhaps the most extraordinary, modern cultural phenomena of the last 5 to 6 years. The smartphone is extraordinary. It's kind of like we have in our pockets what people in the 1980s only dreamed of. I used to watch this show called Inspector Gadget. Did anyone watch that? Or kids watch that? Inspector Gadget, and Penny, I think, was the assistant of Inspector Gadget, and she used to pull out of her pocket this thing, this box. It was actually quite a big thing, relatively, and it had TV on it, and you could talk on it, hands, no wires, and you could do all kinds of things on this little box. We have what was in Inspector Gadget. You know, are we going to have gadget arms next? Is that what's going to happen? The dreams of the 1980s have become reality. Science fiction has become what we are. And of course, you know, the Back to the Future celebration that happened. I think it's only the hoverboard that hasn't been invented. Is that right? They even did the self-lacing shoes. Now that we are in the future, that Back to the Future imagined. But it's amazing how the smartphone has made us feel that we can't do without the smartphone. It's not simply a device, a piece of technology. It's an expression of our culture, our dream to be connected and part of the buzz. It's an expression of something good in us, but also of something quite dark in us. And it's quite distorting of ordinary human relationships. I've just been reading a book called Reclaiming a Conversation by Shirley Turkle is her name. And she just goes, it's quite a lengthy book going through the kind of disastrous consequences of our addictions to our smartphones, for families, for just human interaction, for the way we've forgotten even just how to connect with one another. The Samsung Galaxy S4, which came out a couple of years ago, I'm always two editions of phones behind, was advertised as life's companion. Life's companion. You know, I thought that was my wife. But apparently it was my phone. When you see us on Friday having our weekly lunch together and we're both on our phones at the restaurant table, maybe it has become my life's family companion. So, two things to finish. The first is that we need to rejoice. I think the Bible tells us to rejoice in the blessings of human cultural expression as a gift from God to the glory of God. It's a marvelous gift from God that we're able to express our common love for the world, our ordering of the world through cultural expression. So much of the richness and diversity of human life is found in the way we do things around here, in cultural expressions. For example, the theatre, Thai restaurants, hamburgers, rugby league, Irish dancing, playing the cello, calling everyone mate, although young people call you buddy. I want to protest against that. I hate going to a shop and the guy says, "Thanks, buddy." I'm not an American. Call me mate. Show some respect. Having a birthday, photographing your food. I was on an airplane once to Malaysia and the girl in the seat next to me, the airplane food came out. And she took a photograph of the aeroplane food. I mean, you're not in a gourmet restaurant. What are you going to do? It's just aeroplane food. It's made of plastic. Building an iconic building. Buying a dog and training it not to wee on your carpet. Surfing, cooking, and Twitter. These are all marvelous and rich and diverse expressions of our human cultural togetherness, our human cultural gift. But we need to beware the seductive force of culture. We need to have our eyes tuned to see both the glory and also the tragedy that's involved in our culture. The tragic aspects, the way in which human cultural expression expresses our tragic nature. The illusion that culture breeds something of everything we need, gives us everything we need. That illusion that it breeds, that we have everything we need just here within this expression of humanity and fulfilling every desire we have. It's flawed just as we are. it is liable to shut God out. It is liable to shut his vision of what the good is out and think that it can do everything on its own. If we look with biblical eyes, we will see how tragic it is, how often, even without saying so, it tells us that we can be independent from God. So next week we come back and we hear what God's got to do, God's going to do in response to this tragedy in human culture. And the symbol next week is the temple, and the title is The New Dreaming. Okay. Thank you very much. These are the questions here. It says here, I had believed that the Tower of Babel was a story about man's attempt to get to heaven by our own efforts without God. Was this wrong? No. Not at all. In fact, I think I was saying exactly this, that it's not simply, by the way, it's not simply an individual's attempt, it's a kind of collective human attempt to get to heaven without God. And that's why they try. I think that's exactly what I would say here. But more generally, it's saying about human culture, that human culture does this, tries to make itself a God substitute, and tries to think it is ultimate, that it gives us everything we need, that we can shut God out. We can see that obviously in the ancient Near East, because each city had its own God. We don't quite do that, but still, we do think that Sydney's heaven, right? You know, we do think we've got everything we need here, that we don't need anything else. I think ministering in the eastern suburbs as I do, people genuinely think that having reached this civilization, there's no higher point, there's no place you can go from here. It fulfills human potential and human aspirations. So that's where I go with that. Okay, this one says here, given humans have a mission to create a civilization and cultivate, is there any validity to Christians practicing quietism and withdrawing from the world? I think, so some Christians have said that, or some phases in church history have said that Christians ought to kind of withdraw from the world, perhaps have communities that exist aside from the world, perhaps fight for space in which to practice their Christian culture and have a Christian culture over here, which is different from the world's culture over here. So in particular, in the 18th century, the Moravian Brethren attempted to do this all around Europe, and you see some of those things, some of those evidence, some of those descendants of those groups still do this, kind of do this practice. Some elements of Christianity have always had that. The monastic movement is a very interesting phenomenon because it lasts for 1,000 years or more. And you have to say, you have to be careful about saying it's just world withdrawal, because many of the monasteries were right in the middle of or close to cities and had lots of interaction with cities and saw themselves as actually part of the civilization that they were near. So it wasn't quite what we think of it as being just withdrawal from the world. I don't think there's any grounds for Christians to withdraw from the world. 1 Peter is the great text that we should look at to talk about culture. I think in 1 Peter we have a vision of living amongst the pagans, living such good lives amongst the pagans that they then honour God. So it's telling Christians don't withdraw, and also it invites Christians to live these good lives in the view of everyone. It's hard to do that without interacting with the society that you're in, and also to pray for the emperor and to honour the emperor. And again, so there's a kind of call to be part of the polis, part of the society, part of the culture, in that, while remaining different. The difference comes not from withdrawing, the difference comes from being different within. Miroslav Volf, the great Croatian-American Baptist scholar, I just like to say that, he calls this a soft difference. So he says, yes, there's a difference, but it's a difference for the sake of society, so that they will worship and honour God, but also while living amongst. So also there will be similarities. It's not just creating a new separate culture aside from the culture that we inhabit in any case. Someone might like to come back on that. Secondly here, what of God's words to Cain in Genesis 4:7, that Cain must rule over sin? Is not that to some degree a hopeless task? Was Cain not also a human, tragic figure? How could Cain rule over his sinful nature? I guess, as with many commands in the Bible, there's an expectation that God invites human beings, treats us as adults, treats us as responsible, but yet We are able to see in the Bible our tragic nature, which prohibits us from fulfilling commands, fulfilling the kind of commands we have. Cain was responsible. Was he his brother's keeper? Yes, he was his brother's keeper when he murdered his brother. He should have cared for his brother. He was responsible for the sin that he committed, and indeed he let sin master him. He let his temper and his anger and his jealousy overrule him. Is that to some degree a hopeless task? No, it's not a hopeless task. It's a tragedy is not hopeless. There's a slight difference there. It's important that he does it, even while he's unable to fulfill the task completely. And indeed, the tragedy of our nature, you could look at it as forcing us to despair, saying, look, this is pointless. There's no point in us even trying to be or do good in the world. But in fact, I think our limitation, our tragedy, is an invitation to us to cast ourselves on God, to recognize our helplessness in this regard. And in that, we are liberated, we are given back ourselves, and invited to still keep doing the good that God wants done in the world. Some versions of the Protestant view of justification by faith have been accused of saying, just believe and don't do anything, be inactive. But of course, the faith that Luther spoke of in the Reformation, he was absolutely sure that if you believed in the gospel by faith, that it would drive you to be a fantastic citizen, and to be a great worker, to be a great prince if you needed to be, even. So much more to say there, really. Okay, here. What kinds of human endeavours today would I identify as modern towers of Babel? E.g., there's a couple here. The Olympic movement, the university movement. Well, they're great examples, in fact. I think the Olympic movement is full of hubris. Funnily enough, the Olympic movement also, and FIFA, they're kind of great uniters of the nations. The beautiful game. It's meant to be kind of heaven and earth. We all get together. And what do you know? It's corrupt. Of course it is. In this moment of beauty and peace, human beings wage war with one another. That was the 1980s for me. The Olympics was complete joke. Once we got rid of, once the Soviet Union kind of fell, we then had Ben Johnson. Was he 1988? So you had communist drugs, and then you had capitalist drugs after that. It's sort of, it exemplifies tragedy. I think, interesting that you name here the universities. I think in our modern world, we think of education as the panacea for all our ills. Education, we think, will have a civilizing effect, that we can heal, we can ameliorate the bad in human beings if only we educate. So this is the great vision for sex education, for instance, that if you only tell teenagers about the consequences, then they won't act badly. And of course, that's rot. I mean, it is better to be educated because this shows how it's tragic, right? Because it is better to be educated than not to be educated, and education does help, but education is not enough. In fact, we know that education and civilization is not enough, because we know that in Nazi Germany, you have the most cultivated, civilized, educated nation on earth, and it produces the greatest barbarism on earth. You can listen to, as George Steiner, the Jewish literary critic, said, we now know that a man can listen to Brahms in the evening on his gramophone and go to his work at Auschwitz in the morning. So civilization doesn't bring about human, it doesn't fulfill, doesn't take away the tragedy at all. Education is one. I think also we give psychiatry and psychoanalysis pretended that it would, through therapy, we would deal with human sin. The human tragedy would be taken away. We have a therapeutic answer. This was Freud's vision, and those who came after him. And again, it's proven in many ways. It's a great, and we know sin better, perhaps, but we don't actually heal it. It doesn't actually change us massively at all. I think that's a failed vision. If only we can be rational. That's another one. That's the kind of uber scientist, the Dawkins vision. If everyone was just rational, okay. And someone should tell him to be rational and get off Twitter, I think would be good. But there you go. Of course, human reason has been used for all sorts of diabolical purposes as well. In what ways does Sydney have its own tower building or god of gods, and how does Sydney seek to exclude other cultures and the true god? I wrote a series actually a few years ago on the internet called, on the Anglican Media website, called The Seven Sins of Sydney, and I tried to express exactly this. I think you could tell me, as citizens of this nature, of this city, as much as I can probably tell you here. However, I think Sydney sees itself as this kind of this place of extraordinary beauty, of this place of hedonism, this place of extraordinary hard work, of being in contact with the world. We think we are the world. We think we connect with the world. We think we can have. Just like many cities, I think it's true that the dream that we offer here to people is of the complete fulfilled life, and I see that where I minister. How does it succeed? Seek to exclude other cultures of the true God? I think it lacks humility. It's not a humble culture, and I think it also by shutting out the transcendent. We think we've got the transcendent. When we're out on the harbour and the water is sparkling, well, I mean, that's it, isn't it? What more could you want? Glass of Chardonnay? You've got it all. I think that's where we go. We can have a longer conversation about that. There's much more to say. Genesis 11 to 6. Okay, I'll go quickly. Genesis 11:6 sounds like judgment, but could also be curse and blessing. For example, does this speak to humanity? Humanity can't completely unify in the great sins of slavery, genocide, totalitarianism? I think yes, it's a kind of both a curse and a blessing in verse 6 here. Us being unable to unify actually stops us from doing great, great evil. How does this passage speak to the rest of the Bible? Come back next week. It's telling that Apple's logo is a fruit with a bite out of it, like Genesis chapter 3. I think it's true. It's then the smartphone, the new tower. Google Translate seeks to overcome it. Thank you. I'll take that as a comment. The Pascal quote, does the Bible say we humanity are basically evil? Is this the idea of original sin? I don't know. It doesn't say we are basically evil. It says we are basically good but fallen. So tragic creatures is the right way to think of us. That is, the tragic figure is noble but flawed. We're not demonic. That's a different category, isn't it? The demonic can do no good, is not good at all. We need to recognise the good and the lack of good, or the potential not realised. That's the Christian way to speak about sin in human beings. Are our motives always mixed when we're trying to do good? That's a massively complicated philosophical question, and the answer is, love is never self-disinterested. I haven't got time to go further, but I think it's more complicated. The idea of having no self-interest is almost impossible to consider an act that is completely self-disinterested. So we've got to be careful when we talk about that question there. Does our modern world still look for symbols, events that will unite us? Of course. And someone here says the Olympics is meant to do this. Of course it is. Sporting teams, sports. Sport has this sort of religious ritual about it. It's not accidental. In these massive buildings, these extraordinary buildings that pockmark our city, the getting together of people to sing national anthems, and it's become more ritualistic. It's funny to look, I don't know if you've seen that video of the All Blacks doing the haka in 1973, and sort of going, it's like, you know, heads, shoulders, knees and toes. And it really is. And back in the old days, the cricketers didn't sing the national anthem before the game. They just got on the field and played, you know. Didn't all wear the baggy green. We've actually increased the amount of ritual and ceremony. I think just as we've, in one sense, as we've become more secular as a society, we've made these sporting occasions more and more obviously religious and symbolic, meant to be symbols of our uniting together in some way, our aspirations and hopes. There's something Babel-esque about them. How do I account for the beauty of culture from an atheist worldview? We have to ask an atheist, I think. That's a good question. And I believe that the Tower of... Oh, I've done that question. So I might just go back to this one here. How do you account for the beauty of culture from an atheistic worldview? Well, I think you decide that it's an evolution, a byproduct of evolution, or you decide that um, it, the beauty of culture actually serves us in some way. You go back to the savannah, and it's the person who tells the stories, who unites the tribe, who tells you where, you know, all that sort of logic would be the sort of both neuroscientific and evolutionary biological way of reasoning. I think it's interesting that, that beauty is in excess of, there's a sort of an excess of beauty in our world, which kind of is, it escapes those kind of reductive explanations. Marilynne Robinson, the great novelist and essayist from America, who's a Christian as well, has written very persuasively about that kind of logic, which reduces everything to sort of evolutionary causes like that, and I'd encourage you to look her up. Thank you.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.